You're listening to a Cripple and Co. production.
Welcome to A.G. Parker's Cabinet of Curiosities, an inclusive podcast focused on queer, disabled and marginalised artists and their art. You can support the podcast by signing up to Patreon. And oh my God, guess what? There's a new Patreon tier. If you've ever wanted to ask a writer for advice on drafting or a drag king for tips on wigs, you could now join the Curiouser and Curiouser tier. This lets you ask the talented creatives on the podcast something you're dying to know about art or life or anything, really. And I'll ask the next most fitting guest for their thoughts. This will help me to do things like buy transcript software to make the podcast more accessible. And eventually, if I get enough of you, I can pay my podcast guests. What? I know, wild, right? Find out more on the Patreon page. You can also buy me a coffee on Buy Me a Coffee, which you can find on my link tree. And now, on with the show. I am so excited because today on the podcast, I've got Cass Bradbeer. Cass is a curator who recently graduated from the MA in History of Design, offered jointly by the Royal College of Art and the Victoria and Albert Museum. They have their BA in History of Art from the Courtauld Institute of Art. I can't read this morning, where they curated an exhibition of queer craft and received the Dean's Prize for overall performance. They are now a V&A volunteer delivering LGBTQIA plus tours and researching queer objects in the collection. In general, Cass's research focuses on queer art history and contemporary trans performance, presenting their findings at the likes of UCL and the National Gallery of Ireland. Their curatorial practice has ranged from an exhibition of queer ecology at IMT Gallery to a showcase of feminist commodities at Ugly Duck. And they were recently commissioned to curate a series of drag performances featuring me at the V&A, which is very exciting. Cass, welcome to the podcast.
Hi. Thank you so much, George, for having me on. This is really exciting to be able to talk about it. And I'm, you can't see me, but I'm blushing with all of that. everything that you said. It feels like an exciting transitional phase in my life now coming out of this degree. And it's just really lovely to be coming out of it after having enjoyed, you know, working with you and your performance earlier in the year, and to be still, you know, talking and working with you and these amazing queer talents that I've found myself enmeshed in. It's just a really exciting time.
And you've surrounded yourself with like some incredible talent, and I mean just reading your bio, it's just so impressive. So it's probably quite nice to come on here and take stock of all the wonderful things you've done.
I don't think we do it enough, you know, like just try to sit and like relish a little bit, because I think as I'm going through each of those individual things, they're like, a lot of these things are small, like short-term projects. Yeah. And so you can find it so easy to just go on to the next. And that's very much like what I've finding things overlapping and trying to juggle everything and studying and but then when I just take a moment to just scroll back through my photo album and see my, you know, the selfies we took in the dining hall of the V&A staff room and just thinking, God, that was so delightful. And those moments of you know, human interaction and just seeing myself smiling, that's what I need to keep reminding myself of, because that's what keeps me going into more projects.
And in a weird way, that's like a kind of like a symbol or like a smaller kind of example of what you're doing on a larger scale. So you're using creativity to address gaps in archival records, like, you know, because of like queer history. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the wonderful things at the moment. We've got so much, you know, horrendous things in the news at the moment, and our society as a whole is extremely transphobic. It seems to be getting worse. We're going through a very like horrendous time. So mm-hmm. It's so lovely to kind of be able to look back and say, we've always been here, we've always ridden horrific times, and we've made it through. So I think it's so important that you're the work that you're doing. So tell people a little bit about that.
Yeah, thank you. I always try to do projects that I want to see and that I feel are missing and that I'd want to turn up to. And I think something that I feel that I've been hankering for the longest of time is queer people and just trans people especially taking being given space to share their perspectives on past queer and trans histories that might not be quote unquote factually provable, but nevertheless really important to talk about. And so I think that there's because so much of what our records survive as trans people in history are in sort of the court records or in medical records, and they give such a very small and very, biased insight into what trans lives were like. And so I feel this hankering for the human stories, and that I think needs creativity, because we have that lack of archival records of those things. And so to see artists, I mean, even like with your wonderful work with George slaying the dragon instead of the dragon slayed, I think that is also an extension of this practice in like creatively thinking about how the past has been talked about, how history is written, but putting a trans sort of spin on it. And it's really, really valuable because it makes me smile, it makes us smile, and it also feels really empowering. And it's got that combination of that sort of political ferociousness and just exciting, warm community
Oh wow, I love that you brought my ridiculous
empowerment.
because my brain just does these like weird tangent things, and it's like we just make up stories, don't we? We as, like, and British people have like kind of, we've got this very strange kind of patriotic vibe, which is, and we'll use things like St. George and the Dragon, not an English guy at all, but we'll use that, and we'll use it to fuel like racism, and it's like, what the fuck is wrong with you as a country? Anyway, so that's fun. But
Yes, exactly.
yeah.
So coming with the UK and the state of the UK at the moment, it's all the more vital to be having that, I guess, yeah, that combination of trans political ferociousness and sort of joy and hope, because there is so much to not be joyful about. And there's so much to be angry about, whether it's, I think especially as a young person coming out of school in the hangover of Section 28 and seeing how tutors in my school were still afraid to talk about these things, and then seeing how over the summer there's been that guidance about like gender in how gender should be dealt with in schools that has been sort of floated about and talked about but never properly published, and it's made schools a lot more confused and scared. And I think there's just this atmosphere of constantly firing debate, because if you don't put the guidance out, then there's confusion and then there's debate. 4 years ago they wanted to have the Gender Recognition Act reform, which never ended up. They had all of this debate that they fueled around the survey, and then when the survey came back saying yes, we want Gender Recognition Act reform, then Tories didn't do it. And it's like it's just all of this it's seeming like they're thriving on the uncertainty and the debates around it. And I think there's an interesting space that we can occupy in a positive way there around telling positive trans stories, from kind of saying yes, there's uncertainty, but we've always been here. And we might not know for sure how people have acted or will treat us, but we can tell our stories and make our communities in that way as kind of a point of resilience, and also, yeah, deriving strength from feeling that long legacy.
I think that's a beautiful thing. It is, we are deriving strength from being able to look back and say, hey, we have always been here. Is there a bias in terms of how we viewed kind of figures throughout history and how that's then documented. Are there actually a lot more queer people in history that are missing?
100%. I mean, as I said, the prevalence of medical records and court records give a very skewed lens of what trans experience is to a lot of traditional historians who might not want to read between the lines or think imaginatively about how or critically about why trans people are being shown in a particular way in those records. So the impact of that tends to be that that trans historical figures are often seen as very as criminalized or as villainized, and in the court transcripts or also in medical records as just sort of people who are ill, pathologized is the word, as being being seen as people who are constantly sort of, yeah, then that then transfers into what a lot of especially when I saw, like, growing up early 2000s film representations of trans people, it's always they're either criminals or they're all of their storyline is to do with turmoil over their, like, medical transition.
Yeah.
And it's just that it's missing so much of what trans experiences are about.
Yeah.
And so what I get really excited for is when I see trans creatives and trans historians use their own experience and sort of feel that see something in the past and say, well, that resonates with me. It might not be factually be able to say this was definitely a trans person, but this resonates with my experience, and I'm going to basically then use what I term as a trans dar, a bit like a gay dar, but for, like, trans in history, and thereby, like, using our knowledge, which is really precious and important and should be really valued as having as knowledge as trans experience, to then be able to make sort of informed guesses about trans lives in history. And I think there's a really important place for that, given the lack and the bias in what archival records we have inherited. And so an example of this kind of trans dar in action, it can be very specific. Like, for example, I was looking recently at some contemporary trans artists and performers such as S. Grange and S.L. Grange and Mal Parry, who were producing these performances at the Globe, Shakespeare's Globe, to as sort of versions of this, of somebody called Moll Cutpurse, who was this, like, Shakespearean era, non-conforming performer, convict, and was the subject of all of these satirical pamphlets in their own time. And
icon. Play,
absolute icon. And so seeing how they reconfigure this historical these contemporary trans performers are reconfiguring this historical performer to remind us that we're, I suppose, not alone, and that reminding us that there have been these people in the past who are fighting what feels like the same fight.
Mm.
And that's so important. And then that kind of leads me into the more general application of this sort of trans dar that you get with artists such as the incredible Danielle Braithwaite-Shirley, who put together this Black Trans archive during COVID that was online. And it was basically... it because of the instead of picking an individual figure, Danielle tried to just create a space where we could imagine what Black trans lives and histories might have been like, and I think it's really important to have, yeah, those where there is even less records of, because there's even less records of Black trans histories than there is of non-Black trans histories. Mm. And so when you have such so few records, it's really, I think, important to create these, as Danielle does, these open spaces for people to think and use their trans dars to imagine okay, what might somebody in the 16th century or the 15th century or whatever have experienced if somebody was similar to me?
Yeah, and not just, not just kind of the doom and gloom as well, but I love that you're working with people who are, or encouraging people as well, encouraging performers as well to find a joyful representation that people can see, because having that visual representation and not just kind of reading in a history book maybe, because a lot of us don't, a lot of people who might be needing that, they need it on the in the realm of entertainment. I think that's one of the most accessible ways that we can understand people, society, and history is to have it on a stage and have somebody, perform or enact or like relive their imagined version of what you could be.
Yes, absolutely. It's really accessible, and I think it brings it has, I guess what I was saying earlier about you and George the Dragon, it has that, it makes you smile, and it has that political ferociousness. And I
Oh,
think that
stop it.
combination is really, yeah. I think that combination is really, really important, because it's not just, you're not, we are not trivializing, because there is so much to be angry about. But we also are pointedly expressing trans joy as a kind of riposte to narratives that we are negative, we are criminalized, we are medically unwell because of our gender, like these narratives that we need to go beyond.
We're
And so
looking
that,
to build,
yes, exactly.
oh, sorry, carry on.
No. I was just going to mention how I think there's the academic language that I've seen surrounding these things. There's a really interesting concept put forward by this academic called Sadia Hartman, called critical fabulation. And I really like it, but I just re I just feel this need to I want oh I feel like we are doing it, and I don't think it's explained well enough that we are doing this really important thing. But anyway, so the notion is that because of lacking archival records, so Sadia Hartman applies it to slavery and narratives of slavery, because there's so much of a lack of records. It's really important for people with lived experience or ancestral heritage of slavery to exercise their creative license to make stories of how of histories of slavery, in order to talk about. So she talks about these things as truth stories, not necessarily true stories, and they tell truths about us. And I think that, and so yeah. So it's this notion of going back to history, thinking critically about. So it's critical fabulation, thinking critically about how there's a lack, and then fabulating, creating a new narrative that resonates with the truth that we feel based on our knowledge, our embodied knowledge. And so then I apply that for, I think that a lot of trans performers are doing that kind of thing. And I mean, for example, our lovely Cyro, who we worked with and was amazing. Yes, we love Cyro. Performed with us at the V&A earlier this year. I remember seeing last year this amazing performance in channeling the Nzinga of Ndongo, the king queen, they call them. So this kind of like non-binary ruler, and they put together this spoken word text from the perspective of Nzinga of Ndongo. And I thought that was really, really a powerful example of how somebody was looking back and saying, okay, critiquing that there's a lack of records here of this person's life. Okay, but now I'm now going to respond from my lived experience creatively to, so I suppose, fill that archival gap, make us smile, and also feel that political ferociousness.
That is It's so necessary. I haven't got clever things to say about it. I just think it's absolutely fantastic. You know, like
Isn't it
yeah,
just? It
it's
really is.
it, and it's so fascinating getting to hear it from, you know, your perspective, from a more academic perspective, because you actually know what you're talking about, which is wonderful. I just appreciate it.
It's all a charade, but I mean, this is what I'm saying, is that I think I feel it's when I see trans performers do this that it is made real. And I think I'm such a strong believer in that, you know, if you can't put it simply or lay out an action of how it happened, then you don't really understand it. And I think that being so many times when I was reading those texts and thinking, okay, this makes logical sense to me, but I can't see this in reality. And it's when I see it in reality that I think, okay, now I understand it. It wasn't the reading of the academic text, it was the doing, it was the seeing of people doing.
Exactly. And like it's so important. So I remember last year or the year before, I read an account of it. I don't know if you've heard of the Sturmtucker Viking grave.
No, that sounds cool.
Oh, I think you're gonna love it. Let me try and remember it in good word order and everything. So they'd uncovered this Viking warrior's grave, and because of the clothing, they'd assumed that it was somebody who was quite well off in the community, quite revered, and they had all these gifts, and so they knew that they were respected. But what they then discovered was that actually this person biologically was non-binary. Which was really interesting to see somebody with such high status given all this respect from the community and being non-binary. So they were saying that it was probably somebody who presented quite masculine but wore women's clothing. And they were buried with their sword. And so I went and created a sword based on that sword because I just thought it's like there's this amazing thing that happens when you see like the link through history to other people that have come before. And I know that sounds really silly, but you know, just knowing that somewhere way back when there was someone else who didn't conform and they still had a part and they were still revered and respected and loved. And I just think that's incredible.
Yes, that is so important. And I think people have constantly derived that kind of feeling of solidarity for forever. I mean, look at, you know, Michelangelo trying to hide his queerness and bringing in all of these kind of queer vibey mythological figures into his works, because that was a sort of kind of code or something that he felt that by having it be a classical figure that was revered, he could feel that there was some legitimacy in his identity. You
Oh
know,
my
we've been
God.
doing this for the longest of time, whether you know, these were mythological figures. And you know, like we don't have, I don't have that immediate connect. I don't haven't met this Viking who was in the grove, but I can hear the stories about it, and I can feel that resonance, and then use that creatively to feel empowerment. And I think it all comes back to that thing of, you know, them, who knows whether they were fighting the same fight, but they're fighting what feels like the same fight, and that is really important.
I was also like interested in the fact that they discovered, you know, like chromosomes were non like biologically non-binary seems like such a strange concept to me, and it's certainly, you know, I know it's something that TERFs are always like, look at the biology and blah blah, but they have this weird obsession. But this is the one time that, you know, somebody has dug someone up and found they were non-binary, and I love that because it's like their argument is, you know, in 50 years, if someone, or 100 years, when someone digs you up, like my bones are going to say that I was born, you know, female or whatever. And it's like, what if they weren't? What if, like, they did show that I was a non-binary Viking badass, bitches? So, yeah,
That'll show
that'll show them. I don't know. It's anyway,
them.
really strange. But
No.
how about you with your own personal ancestry? You've got queer relatives, ancestors.
Yeah, so I was a really interesting journey for me, I think, coming to understand my queer ancestry, because I grew up not really being aware of a lot of that, and feeling like I might not fit in with, or being at least alone in my queerness in my family for the longest time. And so to then discover through, I think, when I started to, when I came out, my mum, bless her, started like bringing to me all of these queer figures in our family and being like, oh, do you know about this? Do you know about this one? And her, this
That's
was her way of
amazing.
being supportive. And it was so wonderful and sweet. And so over the years, I've come to understand a lot more. And I'm even now, and I think this is, an important testimony to how there are so many queer people, probably in everyone's ancestry, we don't know about. Even when I thought I knew that there were, oh yeah, okay, so I kind of understand the queerness close family. Recently, I found out that there were, on my dad's side, two great great granduncles who were Jewish collectors of art who lived together, shared a library together, and died bachelors. And I'm really, I'm, I, well, I get very queer vibes from
They were
them.
just friends. They were just
They were
roommates.
just exactly just bros, literally. They were brothers, and so it's so. I just think that they were. They. I feel like they were just because you when if you can find somebody in your family that can really tie you together, if you have that if you can confide in each other in your queerness. So I really wonder whether they were living together and giving each other that safe space they needed to explore their own sexualities, separately, but in the same house, and having that kind of safety there. I mean, it brings us to, and that I think is really interesting. Anyway, I wanted to find out more about him, but the people who I know more about are the Bloomsbury Group Connections, and they were a group of artists in the early 20th century, who lived kind of in around Sussex, but also London in the Bloomsbury Square. They're referred to as having lived in squares and loved in triangles, and
That's beautiful.
there's lots of intermingling of their relationships, lots of bisexuality, and thruples, and also an interesting mix. I find this fascinating of biological family that embraced each other for their queerness, but also chosen family, through their art networks and also university networks. And so there were these, we ended up kind of, you see, we have photograph albums from the time of being, in at Monk's house in Virginia Woolf's house, and there are, a great 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 granduncle of mine, Lytton, and then one of his cousins who was actually straight and a Labour politician, but then his so he was supportive, and then there was my Lytton's cousin, Duncan Grant, there, who was very much queer and ran the Omega workshops and was an amazing artist,
That's
and
amazing.
as is, then people who they'd met who from a younger generation coming in, just being embraced and I suppose taught, or just, yeah, I think that those images of being them out on the lawn, and just who's there, really tells a lot to me and makes me feel like there's a really important place for, for families of queers in whatever form they come.
I think that's absolutely, I mean, like, what an amazing thing to have so many queer people in your queer ancestors. That's amazing.
Yeah, it's really, I feel really, really grateful. And I also think it's really important to acknowledge my privilege in that, because there are a vast majority of queer people are not able to name and identify queer ancestors. But I hope that stories like mine remind, and again, emphasizing how even now I'm finding out new people, who are queer. I think it really, I hope it reminds us that we all, in we all have these queer ancestors. We just might not know who they are, and I think that's where we come back to that importance of imagining, that kind of Yeah, and that's how we can construct feelings of ancestry that can empower us in many ways, even if we don't have the names of people. Yeah, it's really, really special, and I feel very emotional about a lot of that family as well. Sometimes when I feel like I sleep in the bed that my great great uncle Teddy died in, and he was a queer man who lived alone for a lot of his life. And I have his cuttings album that he had all these prints of plays that he wrote, drag dames from the 1920s. He was known as Venus amongst his friends. And I just see, and I see pictures of him. I have a picture of him dressed up in Jacobean, so Shakespearean dress. And I think, God, maybe he was using his queer dar and thinking about the queerness within Shakespeare when he was doing that. And I use my queer dar when I look back at his cuttings of dames, drag dames, and his little photo album. And I use my queer dar and I think about that. And yeah, there's just these long, long legacies. And I feel very, very grateful. And I also hope that they remind us that we all have these, whether we know about them or not.
That's so moving. And I guess in so many ways you're so lucky and so privileged to have a family that has allowed you to have that connection, to kind of bring it to light and to let you see in your lineage there are all these fabulous queer people who had very strong ties and were proud of who they were. A lot of kids don't get that. And you mentioned Section 28 as well and kind of going to school. I absolutely you kind of Section 28 was a real thing. And so many schools kind of continued to live and children continued to live under the shadow of that for many years. Do you think we're coming back to 20 Section 28 style guidance?
I bloody hope not. But I wouldn't be surprised if we are in terms of transness, absolutely. I don't think that we're going to see anytime soon prohibitions against people talking about queerness or sexuality. I think that has been let go, it seems, as a culture war tactic. But as I'm sure you've noticed, it's almost word for word and tactic for tactic, the approaches that the government is taking now to trans people as they were to as Thatcher was to queer people in general, you know. I
It's
mean,
almost identical, isn't it?
and so that's what I see as coming back, and it really doesn't give me hope to see cultural organizations seeming to, even without being directed as such, seemingly at least, they seem to conform to the government's sort of railing against transness, especially with young people. And you see that with, for example, you know, the anyone look at in the news what happened in the young VNA with a trans
Yeah,
object.
I wanted to raise that with
Yeah,
you because that seemed
yeah.
so hypocritical to have trans tales, to have trans performers
Yeah,
come
yeah.
into the museum perform, and then at the same time to remove trans objects.
Yeah, it was really, really disheartening. And I think I'm hoping that there will be larger organizations that are going to hold them accountable, because, for example, the Art Fund, only about since it would have been a year ago, I was first talking to one of the curators, an amazing, lovely trans curator at the VNA, who I really, really enjoy, and I'm so grateful that we're getting some great work being done from the inside to, you know, make things better. But anyway, so this amazing curator had bid for and got a fund for the VNA from the Art Fund for acquiring trans objects. And I think that, I mean, I don't know what's happened, whether the Art Fund has stepped in, but I would imagine that any funder would be quite disappointed to see that they could be giving all this money for acquiring of objects, and then an object that has been acquired, gone through 2-year-plus acquisition process, such as one that was at the LVNA and removed, was then removed from display. I don't think funders would be too happy about giving more money to a museum for objects that they
No.
might not actually put on display or might be taken off.
That's
And
it's
so,
wild.
yeah. So I'm hoping that there will be that there's not just, of course, very, very importantly, there is some that media backlash and protests from within the museum and staff, but there's hopefully also going to be external organisations who are raising red flags at this because well, it's certainly not okay.
When you're talking about a lot of this stuff, though, what it reminds me of is it's like it's very similar to the way that kind of disabled people have been documented through history. So it's very much coming from like the medicalized versions and accounts of them. And I don't know if you remember, I think Richard Sandel was part of Matt, what's his name? Can't remember. Were part of that wonderful project to kind of go through disabled people's history and then have it from the account of the disabled people who were actually there rather than from the medical specialist. So that was fascinating. So I feel like you're doing like a similar thing for kind of trans people throughout history.
Yes, absolutely. I think there's a lot of yeah, shared strategy there that makes total sense because, I think it on as a whole, these projects are all trying to address archival gaps or biases of about marginalized histories. And so and so I think there's a lot of synergy in how those things are approached. But again, as you said, it's about having it from disabled perspectives or from, with Daniel Braithwaite Shirley, it's about having it from a Black trans perspective for her work or with, with the work that I've been doing with trans performers at the Globe about this Jacobean performer. It was looking at sort of like non-binary Londoners looking at themselves in the past and thinking, God, what might have that been like? So it's whilst there is that overarching strategy, it's vital that each marginalized group is talking about themselves from their own perspective, their own lived experience.
Absolutely. It's kind of become a bit like mainstream in the theatre as well. And I only say that because Orlando and Joan of Arc both had non-binary, and obviously that they're kind of they are both plays that could very well play to that. But I just think it's quite interesting that it's become a thing.
Yes, it is really interesting, and I've heard some I went to see Orlando,
Yeah,
and
me too.
I really enjoyed it. But it was quite sexed up, which was, I mean, like go for it. I have absolutely nothing against having things being sexed up. But I guess it just there's that you have I'm hyper aware of the tropes that there are for presenting trans people in theatre and performance, and when they become mainstream, I'm even more aware of how the tropes are being done, and I think tropes tend to be sort of this sexualization, this medicalization, and sort of like villainize or criminalization of transness, and or somebody who's sort of like irrationally aggressive,
And it
and
sounds
so
really strange. I almost thought that like that version of Orlando missed the point of Orlando. And I do wonder if that is because it was like mainstreamed, if it was, if it was made kind of palatable to the masses instead of like this subversive, gorgeous, dark, grimy thing that it could have been.
Yes, I like that. I think it certainly could have done with more subversive grime and less sort of yeah, I think the palatable sexiness is different than the subversive grime, if that makes sense.
And would you have had a like a fat Orlando? Would you have had a black Orlando? Would you have had anything that isn't as acceptable as white androgyny, which is skinny?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that was a lot of my critique as well of when I was looking at my dissertation of how Mole Cut Purse has been depicted in the past. I was looking at a Royal Shakespeare Company performance in 2014, and I was thinking, brilliant that this was happening. I did enjoy it, but also, why does all of these things look like Ruby Rose from 2014 was on the mood board, like can we get
So on point.
past TV, like can we get past these, yeah. So it's just that these tropes that I just get a bit eye-rolly at, so I can, yeah. And I think that brings me back to what I was saying about what I love about the Transformers that we're kind of enmeshed with, is that it isn't just there's some joy, there's also real political ferociousness. And I think that there's when you conform to tropes and you make things palatable and you have just this white stereotypical slim cropped head androgyny that looks like they're straight out of Vogue in the 1920s, like it loses that, well, it can often lose that political ferociousness, or at least dial it down. I think that's a shame. It's a missed opportunity, and as you say,
Absolutely.
it kind of misses what the point of Orlando as a shapeshifter is about.
I've lost you. Have I lost you?
Oh,
Oh, right.
I think you lost me for a second, but I think I'm back.
Okay, you're back. That's great. So enough dissing Orlando, because it was actually, I mean, look, it was baby steps for someone like my mother, who I took to see it. It was baby steps, and it was good, and it's encouraged the use of they them pronouns. So I'm not gonna kick it in the teeth too much.
Oh,
But tell me
okay.
about your favorite trans performers that you've been working with.
So I'm the one that's coming right to mind, just because of how exciting and visceral and beautifully unsettling it was for me. It just means that it just still sticks in my mind over a year later after working with them. But this artist called Joseph Morgan Schofield, who is a non-binary performance artist who works a lot with piercing and fire, came to Ugly Duck to do, this was actually when Cyro did a performance, it was on the same day, this was last year at Ugly Duck. The show was called Trans Tales for Toxic Times, and it was this like crowdfunded event that was put jointly with the Feminist Gender Equality Network that was set up to kind of respond to trans exclusion within feminism. And this performance that Joseph did, really, I felt just it embodied this like ritual expunging of getting rid of the toxicity that the world is putting on us at the moment. And that was partly through the piercing, the self-piercing during the performance, but also I felt brilliantly they didn't tell us, they told us there would be fire. I've seen pictures of their works before. I saw candles. They didn't tell us that there would be a blowtorch. They mid-performance they get out the blowtorch, and I just think, God, you are, I just felt exciting to me because it wasn't expected, and it was fierce, and it felt the it felt a proportionately un like proportionate response of anger and unsettlingness as a feeling for the audience, as proportionate to the toxic times that we're living in as trans people.
That
And
sounds amazing.
it was wonderful, and just, yeah, doing this beautiful performance, walking around the garage space at Ugly Duck with a blowtorching this stick, which had this beautiful ribbon running from it, and then they proceeded to crush dirt under their feet, in this sort of slow, painful looking way. And then they brought this glittered skeleton up down from high on a ladder, and just cradled it as they dripped dirt into it. And it was ritual, but it wasn't clean. It was angry, and It was that kind of, it was murky. It was as we were talking about earlier with Orlando, how it was sort of like clean and sexy rather than sort of like darkened
Yeah.
and grimy. And I thought that was really brilliant. And I have such a place in my heart and feel really important for for queer reclamation of filth and grime.
Yeah. And there's that kind of like primal, that primal sense of like, reconnecting to something and like being a bit feral.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. It's so important. And I think there's a lot of impulse. It reminds me, myself, an impulse to judge myself. I feel a lot easier to be silly in public than I do to be feral. And I think there is a lot of, and I think, and I very much, I think silliness is really, really important, and I love it, and I love to giggle and be silly and to skip around in the middle of the V&A courtyard and just be silly. But also being feral is really an exciting space to sit in.
Yeah, it's so freeing as well. You're like you're disconnecting from the like the male gaze or the, like trying to fit into society's standards and guidelines, and that feels, especially for like a non-binary person, it just feels like, oh fuck yeah, like it's so freeing. I do this number called Danger Wank
Okay,
as
tell me more,
George.
tell me more.
Where I'm on hold to the DWP and I have a danger wank on stage. And I kind of like, I've done this a few times and I reflected on it afterwards last time. I was like, why do I do this? because it's a choice. And I just thought disabled people are so desexualized and infantilized. And then anyone who's kind of like, who was assigned female at birth, we can, we have this kind of like sexualized lens forced onto us as well. So I just thought, I'm going to reclaim my sexuality, but I'm going to be grubby and gross about it in the process. So yeah, anything that's
Brilliant.
kind of like that, I love it. I love seeing people do that.
Yes, and I think it really it makes you think. It sticks in your mind. Just as a feeling a year later from this performance, it's still sticking in my mind. I can remember exactly how it went, what materials were used, what the sort of how it made me feel at every point. I think that's really important. I think a desanitization and embrace of thoroughness, and especially in ways that are non-stereotypical and surprise people, that will really stick in people's minds, and it makes you think. And I think that's really brilliant when you can give someone an entertaining performance and make them feel unsettled, and then that leaves them with this feeling of, okay, I feel unsettled, but I want to think about this now. I'm intrigued because of the enjoyment that I felt whilst watching this. And that's a really wonderful place to leave people in coming from after seeing a performance.
Absolutely. Giving them something that they can carry with them forever. Like it's so important now to find these pockets of joy or of connection. And I think most performances I go to now, it's just, I always come away with something that I'm like, fuck yeah, that's, it gives me strength when you read the news or Twitter or whatever.
Absolutely.
And that's
Absolutely. Much needed.
much needed. So I've got a couple more questions for you. The first one is, and I ask all my podcast guests this, if you were a mythical creature, what would you be and why?
Oh, a mythical creature. I really like the idea of the sea monsters that wreck ships.
Yes.
I would really like to be a mythical sea creature. I feel myself
Cthulhu.
yes, there's something about this in my name. I'm wiggling my arms right now. I can't help it. I'm just imagining myself like I
Tentacly.
Yes, tentacly. I want to be able to selectively grab people off boats that have been, illegally trafficking people. And I want to be able to, but also just float and exist. And I like the idea of being unknowable. That excites me as well, rather than being perhaps a mermaid or those kind of sea creatures. Instead of being a mermaid, where it kind of feels like they've pinned them down as an archetype, I want to be a kind of those kind of Loch Ness typey unknown sea monsters, where it's like, I've become ungovernable, I'm unknowable, and I'm awed, I'm also feared. And that's really exciting. And I'm also just floating with silly little arms and having a great time under
I love that. I think that's the most
the
non-binary answer I've ever had on the
water. You tell I'm non-binary.
That is incredible. Best answer. Love it. Wow. Yeah. Fabulous. Thank you so much. And finally, do you have a piece of art, yours or someone else's, that you'd like to share? You don't have
So
to.
I so in terms of we don't have imagery on a podcast, so I was thinking I love because we talked a little bit about it earlier, but Michelangelo, there is some beautiful poetry that he wrote for his lover, the Roman nobleman Tommaso da Cavaliere, around the 1530s, I did some research on this a couple years ago in comparing them to to some love drawings that Michelangelo wrote. So I recommend, if you're at home trying to search up Michelangelo and Tommaso drawings, especially this one is the Titius, Tityus, it's called. There's this There's it's it's there's this image
Oh
of
wow. Sorry,
yes
I just looked it up.
yes of Titius, like with absolutely ripped body, but lying down and being sort of about to be sort of seized by this eagle. And
And he's like
Michelangelo often,
tied to a rock. Sorry, I just.
yes, exactly. I think it's in God, oh, this has been a while ago, I forgot the story, but it's a rock somewhere. And the eagles from somewhere. But anyway, Michelangelo in his poetry to Tommaso often talks about himself as a quote, like a captive or a prisoner of love who is spurned and grieved by frustrated desire. And the story of Titius is all kind of about like being punished for desire and having sort of like sinful lust. And he talks about in one poem that was accompanied the drawing when it was sent to when Michelangelo sent it to his lover. He said, quote, "If to be happy I must be conquered and chained, it is no wonder that naked and alone I remain prisoner of an armed cavalier." And
Wow.
of course, Cavalier is a pun on Cavalieri, which is the surname of his lover. And so he's the prisoner of this naked and alone. He's the prisoner of this love. This really relates to how in the period in Florence where they were living, tens of thousands of men would be accused of sodomy in a city that also only had about 40,000 inhabitants. And so in another poem that I'll just read quickly a little bit of it, that reminds me of this. He says to Tommaso, "And should the mob, with its stupidity, foist onto others feelings which degrade, no less intense is my sweet longing made." That kind of
Beautiful.
story of power of maintaining that love despite the feeling of punishment. And I
I love
think,
that. I feel like that's
yeah.
like a queer like motto or something that we should keep close to our hearts, like going forward. That's wonderful.
Absolutely, absolutely. So yeah, I recommend everyone read more of that poetry. It really it made me really emotional, and there's some beautiful, beautiful drawings. Also lots of very weird vibes in the classical references they're taking themselves. So you have to kind of read that with a pinch of salt. There's some weird stuff about attacking, torture, all the rest. But
Okay.
the thing is that like he's finding these stories that are But oh, he's like, okay, well, at least there's some queerness in here, and at least it's classical. I can use this and feel like I'm legitimate in my feelings. And so I think there's a lot of that in our lives that we look back and we say, okay, where can I draw something from this? And the histories don't have to be perfect people to draw some power of feeling that we've always been here, you know. And I think that's really important as well, and reminds me of brilliant podcast, it was like in a book called Bad Gays, you know. It's really important to look back and see things with critical and with sort of hopeful lenses. So yeah, that's how I feel about Michelangelo. He's a bit of a weirdo, but I feel a lot of love for him.
All the best people are, right? All the best people are.
Yes.
What advice would you give to people who aren't necessarily, because I wouldn't say that I would often go and spend my time looking around an art gallery, but if people are looking to find a bit more about like kind of queer culture or queer culture through history and art, where would you recommend they go? Or what would look up or do?
I mean, Ugly Duck is an incredible space in Southeast London. The New London Bridge Station has a this run by an amazing trans creative director who do lots and lots of amazing performance events in their space. Constantly doing new stuff and also giving their space for free to a lot of like trans organizers and queer performance organizers, and that I think they do really, really important work, and it's really enjoyable. It's just great stuff being done there. And then also Queer Circle is an amazing space as well that I'd recommend going to, which is near the O2. And that's a kind of queer contemporary art space, and that has also another a rotating program of exhibitions, and they do quite a few workshops as well, so they're really fun if you want to go to like events like that. So yeah, those would be my highlights, but I'm trying to hold myself back because there are too many amazing things that I would want to say. I must say though, if you're interested in amazing arts, interested and just really cool stuff that's going on, and recently Arts Council funded, this is an nightlife drag show, go to the MB show. Amazing
Oh
performers
God, go to
there.
the MB show. Yeah,
Yes,
absolutely.
absolutely,
I
absolutely. I'm
had the honor of doing the MB show showcase last not last week, the week before, and it's just amazing. They're amazing. I love the MB show so much. They are just fierce and funny as
Absolutely
fuck.
brilliant stuff. I'm really looking forward to. I just got tickets for
Rocky
Rocky
Horror?
Horror.
Yes, us too. Like so excited. Oh my God. Oh my God, see you there.
Yeah, see you there.
So cool.
And you, listeners.
Yeah. And you at home. Wonderful. Have you got anything to promote? Have you got any anything that you're putting on anytime soon?
No, not really. I'm just in this limbo phase, really, coming out of my degree, trying to find a job. It's a weird time of life, but I'm excited to see what's coming up next. So if you want to get me involved in something, please do. This is my time. I'm looking for things to do.
Oh fuck yeah, everybody employ Cass.
Thank you. But I will say I do once a month I do tours, LGBTQI plus tours, last Saturday of the month from 4 to 5 p.m. at the V&A. So come along there if you want me to show you around. I include an image of Moll Cutpurse on my tour, so you can hear more about that. And I also show an image of me dressing up as Moll as my kind of like creative reinterpretation of the history, because I like to try out myself as well. So yeah, come along to that if you can.
That's so cool. That's wonderful. Cass, it's been an absolute delight having you on. Like, it's
Oh,
wonderful.
I've
Thank
loved
you.
it. Thank you.